Shane McRae. It was difficult for me to write this introduction. Shane is a great friend, mentor, poet, guardian, person to hang out and talk about video games with. So I feel like every time I tried, it would immediately transform into cloudy sentences like Shane is the best poet, which is not what one wants to do for an introduction. So instead, I decided to pull a little stuff from some recent emails that would help me write this failure of an introduction. And what I got was, dang, dang, dang. This was on receipt of some poems that I read. Dang, dang, dang. That's the sound of all my bells danging when I read this. Really inspiring, as in the supernatural breath-filling language. Overflowing and then breezily danging those bells again. You know when you remember that imagination exists and is a beautiful thing is what I'm doing constantly while reading, especially during the event, which is this current event. Remembering the beauty of the internal is a gift. I guess that's the gift of imagination, but it reminds me how rare that gift is. And again, it's so beautiful to feel the richness of poetry, pushing the graphics card of language. Poetry 2.0 NVIDIA GeoForce overclocking hack. Shane McRae's poetries range from the personal in books like Forgiveness, Forgiveness to the political, historical, like in The Language of My Captor, all the way to the divine, like in the upcoming Sometimes I Never Suffered out in August from FSG. All while sneaking in an epic, the Hell Poem, weaved through a handful of these recent books, stipulating the differences of each of these zones, the personal, political, historical, divine, and I guess epic, in order to express their conjunction through all kinds of formal inventions, looping syntax, metrical distortion, imagery which becomes portal for a variation on that very image, all producing a poetry that is a kind of divine comedy omega, time suspended, orchestrating the death hymns with a sick pedal board and an early 90s production budget, all in a cohesive yet expansive vision. As Shane's Twitter bio suggests, Derek Walcott once said, I signaled the end of poetry. At first, I took Walcott to mean this in the sense of a swan song, which makes too much sense currently in this pandemic to be true. Ending a recent Jim Limber in Heaven poem, Shane writes, I think now more than half of life is death, but I can't die enough for all the life I see. So instead, I've started reading Walcott's end of poetry as the end of one side of the face of poetry, like Auden's end of the poem suggests, that the end is really the beginning of an afterwards type of reading, which means that it is also the beginning of a new kind of poetry we can't yet know what it will look like. Shane McRae's newest books are The Gilded Auction Block, Sometimes I've Never Suffered, both out from FSG. As I mentioned, that latter is out sometime in August. He's received a Whiting's Writers Award, an NEA Fellowship, a Lannan Literary Award, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and an Anisfield Book Award. He lives in New York and teaches at Columbia. Please welcome the beginning of poetry, Shane McRae. After I unmute.
oh, I'm unmuted now. Okay, cool. So anyway, Tasso, thank you for the introduction, which was fantastic. And thank you and Ian for having me here. Thank you, Bob, for reading. The thing about Derek Walcott is true. He came to Iowa when I was a student there. And when he got back to New York, he told one of his students that I personally signaled the end of poetry. And I have never forgotten it. It's actually, if you read the little New Yorker memoir that came out after he died, the one or two page notice, it's the first anecdote in it. It's me. So it would be nice, I know, if I were to read something that somebody could buy ever, but instead I'm gonna read from a book that I've just finished, which is terrible, and I feel bad about it, but that's where we are. And I'm going to start with this poem called The Memoir, which is as close as I have ever gotten to writing a villanelle. The Memoir. George Trockle died of cocaine all my life. The stories I was told replaced my life. My father's father died when I was 8. The stories I was told about my father, he didn't come, he came to my birth late. George Byron died of fever all my life. My father lived in Oregon, then Brazil, with 2 new children and a dark-skinned wife. My father's father died when I was 8. Too far away to visit me. My mother's parents told me not to wait. George Moses Horton died of blank all my life. My father's family stole and did drugs and was black. His brother, with a hammer or a knife, murdered my father's father. I was 8. My mother's parents knew you have to kill the child with what you want the child to hate. Her kidneys killed George Eliot all my life. My father's father died when I was 8. So I meant to be like reasonably polite and start a timer, and then I didn't, but now I've done it. So this is a poem I wrote 2 days ago. It's called The White People in My Blood. What do I know about the white people I don't know in my blood? Does their blood pale my father's where it meets his blood? Where in my body does the pale blood meet the dark blood in my heart? How red might it have been were my blood pure? My heart, which red? How much of which red red? A pale red or a dark red? Blood red. Heart red, white, blood white as blue day in the heart. Black blood in the heart, black as the breathing sunset. My father's 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 heart might all day long have pounded toward, then through. Whose heart kept him awake and running all night, maybe, or his father's blood rushing, if either ran. Who runs still in my blood? Who chases? Whose blood darkens where they meet? Who fights still in my heart? For what? What violence is the beating of my heart? So I said I was going to read from the next, well, not the next, the book after the next book, because I just finished it. And I am calling it, I Hear the Wild Birds Singing Tangled Rose. And that is named after, titled after this poem, which is also has that really long title. And it's also kind of really long. It's like 3 pages. It feels long for Zoom. It's called I Hear the Wild Birds Singing Tangled Roads. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. I have opened a window in Manhattan twice as tall as it is wide window on the 4th floor. In R, the sticker on the door, a sticker like the sticker on the door of a hotel room. I have opened a window in R. The sticker says it's fireproof. I have opened at the far end of our fireproof building in our fireproof apartment at the back that stretches from the middle of the building to the back, our building next to the big rock. So big, you hadn't noticed it. Our daughter, who next to me before had leaned not out, not through the screen, but to the edge of the window, leaned to the window, even pointed, not through the screen, but if I hadn't known she was pointing at the rock, I might have thought she was pointing at the screen and not the rock, but she was pointing at the rock. And when I told her, when I said the thing she was pointing at was a big rock, she looked at me like she was looking at a screen, like she had stopped to look at the thing she was supposed to look through. I had hoped she would look through me to see the thing I told her was the world, the big rock in it. But how long ago last week we stood in front of the rock, and she said she had never seen it, or she had seen it, but had thought it was a road. The screen makes grids on things like land surveyors make. So big, it's not a natural part of the world. It's easier to think a will like hers, the will that made our building that stands where it stands. Because if it was 124 years ago, developers who didn't want to spend money to blow up the rockets, easier to think the will that makes the window makes the rock. It's 9:26, I have opened a window, I have stood at the screen, at the window, and only heard, I hear, now only still, birds, their songs clashing now, and full of no one walking where before, of the gone people who before soaked up the singing. I hear the wild birds singing tangled roads. I see the rock that was a road. So, I have been trying to write love poems, love sonnets for my partner, Melissa, and have only been, I was gonna say so successful, but that would imply some degree of success. So this is one of them. It's called Nowhere is Local. And you'll hear it and you'll think, oh, that's hardly a love poem at all. Okay. 10 years and we to New York now, have moved from Iowa to from Ohio, how far from New York to anywhere now, I don't know. But everywhere seems here, or visits and nowhere is local. I've never anywhere I've lived before wanted to be buried where I've lived, but have ignored live long all my life, the longest part of life, from fear or fear of the diminishment of love or of love from the diminishing of joy, but greet it here with you, the longest part of life. It can be, is a joy to want to be dead somewhere, is a joy to rest the heart. Let me die here where I don't want to die. Oh good, I just took one of the earplugs out and like I can hear, it sounds okay. This poem is a poem I wrote for Lucy Brock Broido after she died. It's a lot of heavy poems, man. It's called A Letter to Lucy About Lucy. She gave it with her living hand to me, a copy of the master letters with her living hand to me, thick with the thickness they now, I can't say, how many reprintings later new copies have lost. The paper they're printed on is thinner now, but it itself was new. She gave it to me new. She must have had it since the book was new to her. She must have kept it in her castle. She signed it in the little castle that was where we were. Together, she, you must have kept it in your castle for 20 years, master. How long had you lived in the castle before I, for a single afternoon, came, where are you, to ask? I think the castle followed you your whole life, and now you've taken the castle to wherever you have gone, master of now, gone from now. She must have kept that copy for 20 years before she, with her living hand, gave it to me, a paperback, still glossy with the printing date, 497, still glossy beneath the gloss, our master was it printed on the gloss, as we are, we who walk on earth are printed on the gloss and liable to smudge and disappear if touched. I ask you, where are you to ask? I might have called you after I heard, but let me tell you, first, we were then underground waiting for a train, my daughter and I waiting for an A or D to ride it down to 14th Street when I heard a woman go under the train. And the sound must have been the train crushing her body, but the sound sounded like a piece of paper tearing, that was all it sounded like. Then screaming, and the screaming was the sound I turned to. Master, then I turned my daughter's face away. I might have called you after, I might have said it sounded like paper. Master, where are you to ask? Do you know now to whom she was master, the woman beneath the train? You must have kept it in your little castle, not for me in particular, but but for whomever would be there calling you when your love was called to cross the bridge from hand to hand, the book would for a moment make as it was given. And I was there, I called you, and you with your living hand took the book down from the shelf beside the sprig of heather from the Bronte's moors and handed it to me. A sprig that looked alive still of green heather from across the sea. When I was writing the newest book that I've been working on, I was kind of excited to return to some really old poems and try to make them like semi-tolerable. And this is one of them. It's called How Could Anyone Love God in Heaven? Grandmother, in the books I read, I know you never had the chance to read the books I read. But in the books I read, the theologians argue we sleep between death and the new, life on the new earth, we don't go to heaven. No singing hymns forever. You sleep and you won't wake, confused, your strength will come back, you won't choke because you have forgotten how to swallow grand. Mother, remember, you were hungry. My mother, even as she fed you, knew you probably would die choking. Even as she watched you swallow and live, swallow and live, swallow and live. Grandmother, how could anyone love God in heaven? Who loves who seeks to be spared by love? This is another one of those old ones. A lot of these older ones, this one in particular, I really had no hope I would ever get it to, you know, reasonable shape, and who knows whether I have, but for whatever reason, I'm fine with it. It's called Whom I Have Blocked Out. Asked, have you ever asked, ridden a horse before? Said, he's real gentle, and lifted me up. I trusted what men said was gentle to hurt, and I knew I couldn't say no to what men said was gentle and lifted me up. Onto the horse, no saddle he, without a saddle seemed, naked the horse seemed more, naked than I could make myself naked, but not as naked as I could be made to be. Lifted me up from the day at the farm, into the memory already, forming me bent low, shivering, clinging to the mane alive, but not as part of the body of the horse, alive as part of the wind, the fire at the end of the wind. Me burning in at 6 years old by six, I have already been a sickness in the hearts of men. By six, I have been the sieve through which they expel their sickness. Said, you ever ridden, said the man, who must have been the father of the friend from school who had invited me to the farm. And this is how I have forgiven him. I have remembered only the beginning of the ride, then nothing than the bath in the trough in the field, far from the house in the brown water, stripping in the field. Your body is a gift you have to live through. Remember me, my suffering to me. To whom have I been suffering? To whom will I be healed? So the first half of the newer book is half those sorts of poems, whatever those sorts of poems are, I guess, kind of personal family poems. And then the second half, Tasso mentioned, I've written this kind of epic poem, and the middle section is called the Hell Poem. And I wrote a bunch of kind of continuations, alternate continuations of that poem, but they're all posited as sort of alternative versions, alternative endings, so that the second half of the book is in some sense fan fiction, which was Tasso's idea. The other part of the second half is a few poems about this group I'm calling the Lost Tribe of Eden. And this was the poem that kind of got me trying to redo old poems, because this was a poem that I wrote. It was actually my kind of first real publication. So I wrote it when I was in grad school, and then like revised it heavily, like I don't even know how many years, 17 years later. This is The Lost Tribe of Eden. They knew they'd disappear. They knew the stars and sun shone for the naked pair. They knew not to complain. They knew they couldn't choose the prayer God finally would answer to. What if it was no prayer? They knew the fields outside the garden were alive and growing. They knew to fear. They knew God hadn't said enough about the tree. They knew the use of knowing. They knew the angels knew the will of God. They knew the angels whispered late at night. They knew the fruit. They knew the apple wept in their mouths when bitten, like a good smell on the serpent's tongue. Him they knew best. On his long legs, he stood as tall as people. This is the second to last poem, I should add. This is the lost tribe of Eden at the beginning of the days of blood. Each night, the trees at the edges of the garden stretched close together, and the slender branches of each tree intertwined with the slender branches of its neighbor, and the leaves of one enfolded the leaves of the other, and the trees together made a wall and partial roof. The people of the tribe of Eden saw the colors of the Milky Way above them. If they looked directly up, if they leaned so far back, they almost lost their balance, tilting their heads back to the edge of falling. But if they looked ahead and up, the wall blocked what they all imagined were more stars from the moment the first stars appeared each night. At the horizons, God rehearsed the world, struggling especially to get time right, and held the night and colors in the sky above the garden, wheeling days around it like a whirlwind, one, the next, each bloodier than the day before it, endless blood, but fitting in a finite space of time. But how? God first thought time itself was flawed, but time was God's first mirror, as impossible and simple as themselves, almost. It was flawless, almost, no, a flaw from which blood poured endlessly had to be something else, and God reset the days again and spun them forward and reset and spun them, and for generations of the tribe of Eden, God rehearsed the world until one night a boy who hoped to see the sky beyond the edges of the visible climbed one of the trees in the wall of trees, the tree, though it had stretched to stop the tribe from seeing the sky at the horizon, stood still, and it was a tree. A boy was climbing, being a tree, and the boy climbed quickly through the canopy and saw the whirling days and saw faces like his in the days and faces like no faces he had ever seen, and raw, incomprehensible machines. And blood none in the tribe had seen, blood before. Even the happiness he saw looked strange to him, shadowed as if with the shadows at the edges of the wall. The stunned boy lost his balance and fell through the canopy to the garden floor and broke his bones, and bones broke through his skin. The boy's blood glistened on the rocks and flowers. So this is the last one. Thank you all for hanging around. This is called The Beginning of Time. One, the lost, oh, I should say before I go, because I guess I'm excited about it. The second part of this is the closest I'm probably ever gonna get to writing a pantoum. Okay, so The Beginning of Time. One, the lost tribe of Eden and the word. The tribe of Eden watched The tribe of Eden watched time enter the garden. What they saw, a sky-wide lake, a shallow, pale blue, paler than the sky was blue, but flowing like a river, but a circle, not a line, but flowing like a lizard flowing in the cage of a child's hand, although they had no word for cage. Time floated in the air above them like a glass cloud, between them and the sky, although they had no word for glass. A glass cloche lowered from far behind the sky into place between them and the sky, although they had no word for cloche. And from the cloche, the cloud, a sky that wasn't the blue sky behind the glass, a layer of the underside of the glass peeled from the glass and fell, and falling melted in the air, and melting either clung to everything and everyone in the garden or evaporated completely. No one in the tribe knew. This happened years before the man and woman came. At first, the tribe had no word for years, but they adapted the word that once had meant unending. 1A, how things in the garden ended before time came. A song would pass from mouth to mouth, one mouth to the next mouth, until each member of the tribe had sung, the last born first, the first born last. One mouth to the next mouth until the song became a long, low scream. The last born first, the first born last, forgot the song had been a song. The song became a long, low scream. Even those who had only sung forgot the song had been a song. They forgot even what songs were. Even those who had only sung, those who had sung each end in words, they forgot even what songs were. They had no words and never had. Those who had sung each end in words had sung as each fruit was consumed. They had no words and never had, when instantly each fruit grew back. Thank you.